Good morning. The online task force will come to order. The online learning task force will come to order. Today is Tuesday, November 17th, 2009. It's 8 a.m. And this is the fourth of our meetings as a task force. We have a lot of work ahead of us, and I really appreciate the effort and time and speed that all of you at the dais and all of you in the room have put into this up to this point in time. Today, first of all, before we get too far into the meeting, please make sure that you have turned off your cell phones, your Blackberries, your PDAs. And I know that there are a lot of people listening on the internet because partly because of the subject matter. And if your phones are on, even if they don't ring, there's interference, and that makes it really hard for people to hear that are listening from remote locations. So please be considerate of those across the state that are interested in what happens here today and turn off your cell phones. So today we are going to have an informational meeting on legislative concept 15, and there have been some additions to this since we last met. The co-chair and I received these yesterday afternoon and sent them out immediately upon receiving them. And as you know, sometimes there may be adjustments between what gets put in and how it's written, and that's part of what today is for. So we're going to start with an overview of the concept from Hannah Lai, who is the legislative counsel who wrote it, and then we're going to follow up with some public testimony, and then we'll have the opportunity to deliberate a bit as a task force moving forward to our one final meeting. Do you have anything you want to add, Senator Devlin, before we...
The only thing I would add, Representative Gelzer, is I do believe that staff has worked very hard between now and the last meeting, and I'm including Ms. Richardson to my left here. In that, because I think she has borne the brunt of the vast majority of the work, and some of the other people. And the Legislative Council, I think, has captured a lot of what we tried to do in terms of a task force, and the information that the co-chairs relayed to her from our discussions. But I think there are a few cases in which we were perhaps not as explicit as we should have been, and I think... If there are issues within the LC where we think there needs to be more clarity, I think it's both a shared responsibility between Legislative Council and the direction that we gave Ms. Richardson and Legislative Council, because I think they both did a very good job. But I just think that there are some sections that may cause people, regardless of their persuasion around this issue, they may have some issues with how some of them are written. And that is just normal, actually, in amendments. We're just working hard to make sure that when we come back again that we can have something that is down pat to where we believe the task force is at this particular juncture. So,
thank you very much. And before we invite Legislative Council up, I also wanted to be sure you all know that Dennis Dempsey and Kathleen Scalise are both joining us on the phone. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Great. All right. Hannah.
Good morning, members of the task force. I am Hannah Lai, Legislative Counsel. Before you, you have LC 15, Part 2. And I guess, unless there are any questions right off, I'll just kind of walk you through it and say what's going on. Does that sound okay?
That would be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
So the first section, Section 1, amends Section 8, Chapter 691, Oregon Laws 2009, and that's a section that imposes additional requirements on the virtual public charter schools in addition to what charter schools also have to follow. So one of our first changes is going to be in that subsection 1D, involving the budget, business plan, and governance plan. And in that paragraph, what we have said is that the budget and accounting system of the school must be compatible with the budget and accounting system of the sponsor so that they can talk to one another, and to the extent practicable, comply with the requirements of the Uniform Budget and Accounting System adopted by rule of the State Board of Education. So that way everybody's kind of on the same page, they're looking at the same terminology, everything should be at least in the same terms. The next change that we have is in paragraph F. We had done some changes in this paragraph with the first version of LC 15 by requiring that administrators be licensed. There was some concern about what exactly is meant by administrators, so the terms superintendents, assistant superintendents, and principals have been included in there, and that's pretty much the definition that the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission uses for the term administrator. So we can tweak that as we need to, but that's the term that's out there for now. The next paragraph with the teachers, that's what was from the previous version of LC 15. The next change is in paragraph K. That was, again, from the first version of LC 15, where we're clarifying what biweekly means. We're saying it's twice a week. The next changes are M, N, and O. Those are actually also from the first version of LC 15. The question had been raised if an interpretation could be made that the notification to the other school district or to the sponsor was only upon request. I do not think that's the case. I think the language is fairly clear that it is a requirement. It's not the virtual public charter school does not have to wait for a request. It is required to do it automatically. So we did not tweak any language there. In contrast, the education records in paragraph O is only upon request. We made some slight tweaks in the subsection 3A and B. We might have to do some additional tweaks related to that. Maybe more of a reference to public records instead of personally identifiable information. That's something that I believe Morgan Allen from Department of Ed will be talking about a little bit more. And then the final change is a new subsection 4, where we're saying that the virtual public charter school may not misrepresent where the funding of the school came from. And that's to be clear that the school has to say that if it uses public monies, it does get money from a public source. So any questions right off on that, or do you want me to continue?
Madam Co-Chair, I think from our discussion yesterday, what we were going to do is have Legislative Council go through this, then public testimony, and then obviously have the committee go through it. And if the Legislative Council would remain around for that, actually, I think that's, unless people had just burning questions they wanted to get to right now.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Devlin. So I'll continue on. So Section 2 refers to the amendments and all the requirements we just went over, and that's to say that those requirements apply for the 2010-2011 school year and moving forward. So these schools would have a few months to be able to transition and meet those requirements. The next sections, 3 and 4, are amending the same section, and what they are saying is that the State Board of Education may not waive any of these requirements from Section 8 that apply just to the virtual public charter schools. The next changes are in Section 5. And the primary change that we're seeing going on is in subsection 1, subsection 2A, capital B. And this is really getting into the Orva situation. There had been some concern about how many students can Orva have after their waiver expires. And this specifically addresses what would happen for the Orva situation, saying that if Orva increased the number of students it had within the terms of its waiver, it can keep students up to that amount, regardless of how many students Orva had on May 1st, 2009, which is the cap that other schools have. So we are trying to clear that for that expired waiver.
Could I ask a question on that?
Yes.
I've been on the road, and I haven't had time to review this document, so I'm a little behind maybe some of you, but just wondering, could you explain that a little more in detail, what that means as far as the cap goes and the future? What does that mean?
Yes, Chairs and Mr. Glaze. What happened was Senate Bill 767, and primarily this provision, Section 17 of that bill, had said that as of May 1st, 2009, a virtual public charter school cannot increase the number of students that are outside of the district of the sponsor of the school beyond the numbers of May 1st, 2009. And there are a series of exceptions. One of the exceptions is if that virtual public charter school has a waiver and complies with that waiver. Later in the process, unfortunately, we found out that there was this unaddressed situation, which is basically ORVA. And in that situation, ORVA has a waiver. It's a valid waiver. It allows ORVA to extend, to increase the number of out-of-district students it has. But then the concern is, what happens when that waiver expires? And that waiver will expire before July 1, 2011, which is when this section expires. Mm-hmm. So the question was, well, does ORVA have to go back to its May 1st, 2009 number, or can it go, can it remain at the terms of the waiver that were allowed by the waiver? Mm-hmm. And so what this does is go in and says, yes, the school, even though it does have an expired waiver, as long as it complied with the terms of that waiver, it is okay to operate at that level. It does not have to return to the May 1, 2009 numbers.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. So the next major change would be in the subsection 4. And what we are saying here is that the State Board of Education can consider waivers of that out-of-district prohibition for the 2011-2012 before July 1, 2011. And what this is happening here is, again, a school is not allowed to increase the number of out-of-district students it has until July 1, 2011. But we're saying, regardless of that, the State Board of Education can consider it so that they can act on July 1, 2011 to give the school enough time to make any changes or to meet any requirements needs to in preparation of the 2011-2012 school year. So it's just allowing, it's telling the State Board of Education does not have to completely stay still, it can't do any official acts, but could be prepared to act when it's allowed to again on July 1, 2011. Section 6 is a new section giving many directions to the State Board of Education. The first thing that the State Board needs to do is develop a governance model for virtual public charter schools. And there are about four requirements here that it must have in that model. One is addressing how virtual public charter schools should be made available to the students of the state. Second is to provide a process for determining whether a school district should be the sponsor of a multi-district virtual public charter school. Third is to ensure that the model protects the student's ability to choose the school at which the student will enroll. Fourth is to ensure that there's competition among providers of educational services. In addition, the State Board of Education is directed to study the appropriate levels and methods of funding virtual public charter schools, including looking at whether part-time, how part-time students should be funded and whether that's even should be an option. And the third thing that the board is directed to do is consult with the State Advisory Council for Special Education and other similar organizations to determine how virtual public charter schools should be serving children with disabilities. Finally, the State Board of Education is directed to present all of this information to the Legislative Assembly or the committees of the Legislative Assembly by February 1, 2011. Section 7 addresses what those committees should be doing, which is to look at the information provided by the State Board of Education and to determine whether virtual public charter schools should be governed by the same statutes as the public charter schools or if there should be some other form of governance for them. And then the committees are also directed to make recommendations for consideration for the next Legislative Assembly. And then finally, there's an e-clause so that everybody can start doing what they need to do to do all this. That's basically what's going on in the bill.
Are there any, Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Representative Gelser. I have a question that's kind of a drafting question, so I thought it might be appropriate at this point. Hannah, I was wondering in section, it looks like it's section 1, but my concern is on page, hang on just a second. on page 4, where you said it's to clarify that the virtual charter school has to provide the information about the student that has withdrawn. Why is that drafted in the form of a plan? Why isn't it just a directive? Like, the virtual public school shall provide notice to the school if a student withdraws. Why is it in a plan format? I'm just a little
Co-Chair, Senator Bonamici, that is language that's consistent with the rest of the language that is throughout the rest of the statute. It is language that could be stronger, and to make it directives instead of just saying plans. The reason I did choose language is to make it consistent. That may be something that this task force would want to consider, is whether to look at all these situations throughout the section that already use the terminology plan or agreement, and to decide whether you want to be saying you will do this instead of you will just plan to do this. But this was language that was agreed upon with the Senate Bill 767. I just made it consistent within that framework.
Thank you. Are there any Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Getting back to the caps and waivers and that whole issue, I just want to make sure that there's nothing in the bill that would prevent, say, Fossil School District, which is now a charter district, from the school board contracting with one of the virtual providers for an entire class, say the entire fifth grade class for math, sixth grade class for science. Is the cap that's in here going to prevent the school board from doing something like that? If contracting for 20 students is going to put ORCA from 2,600 to 2,700 or something like that, I just want to make sure that the caps are not preventing a school board from doing something for the entire district or an entire class.
So let me ask a clarifying question before we get to Hannah. Are you talking about the school district on its own enrolling a population full-time in the class, or are you talking about the school district basically offering their own charter program?
The school district contracting with, say, K-12 to provide an entire class fifth grade math, or the junior class, some AP class that they cannot get locally, or all the seniors are going to take French, whatever that situation
might be. So it sounds like A-class, the hybrid type of a model where
it would be a hybrid type of model, but I want to make sure that those students, the school board would be allowed to contract, even though technically I guess that would put K-12 over their cap.
Can I get a clarification in this, Madam Co-Chair?
Yes.
Because I think there are several different issues that are being asked here. One is, could they contract with K-12, or could they contract with Connections, not ORCA, but the provider? That's not actually, wouldn't put them in an issue with the enrollment cap, because that would be a contract between the vendor and actually the school, would be my understanding. Not the virtual charter school. It would be a contract between K through 12, which would be totally separate, or one of the other vendors. Could they contract with ORCA or with ORVA or one of the other ones that were capped directly? I think is a different question, because that question would be, does it affect their enrollment cap? And I don't think that's actually directly answered, although it would, my guess is it, well, I'd only guess, and guessing is guessing is problematic. But I think going backwards, though, that the issue is they could contract for services with a K through 12 or Connections Academy. The question would be, though, that might affect the enrollment cap, actually, if they contracted directly with ORVA or ORCA. I don't know.
Yes, Senator Devlin, Representative Huffman. I would agree with the direction you're going, that the cap is on the school itself, not on the provider. So as long as the school that you're talking about is only contracting to provide virtual public charter school educational services to students in that school, it is probably okay if that if we're starting to look at students in another school district, that's when the cap ends up being the problem. And the cap is not on the provider, it is on the school itself. So you need to look at the person who is giving the educational services. So if you're talking about a school that is in Fossil, look at that school. Don't look at, you know, Orla.
Is there any way that we can have some language that allows a school district to, you know, even if, say, Orca is capped, the school district has, for whatever reason, chose Orca as the model they want to go with? Is there some kind of language to it? On the school district part of it, on what Hannah just said, you know, I could see situations where there are two school districts close together, like Condon and Fossil, both do some sharing now. Dufour and the Dalles do some sharing. They're different school districts, but they're close enough that they do some sharing. So if Condon contracted and some juniors from Fossil drove up to, or they bused six students up to Condon for the class, you know, that could be mixing school districts. So,
and I think the difference, let me see if I can try at this clarification, is that the cap is on the virtual charter, where that is the entire school community that's providing the school experience. There's nothing in the law right now that precludes Fossil School District or Condon School District from reaching agreement or making a contract with a private provider, whether that provider provides textbooks or that provider provides online instruction.
And even if the provider's student cap is already maxed out?
We don't cap, the provider itself isn't capped. That's a vendor that's available to, anyone could go and do business with that vendor if that's what that school board chose to do. It's only if for the cap to apply in that case for Fossil, what Fossil would be doing is disenrolling those students from the Fossil School District to enroll them in, if it was Orca, in SIO.
Even so, on a per class hybrid type of a model?
Because what the school is right now, the virtual public charter school, is a full-time enrollment where that student is full-time enrolled. So there isn't a model right now in which that would.
I guess that's what I'm getting at, what I want to protect, because I think there's been some discussion of hybrid models. And early on I had mentioned that I want to make sure that for the small school districts that aren't surviving, that would be an option for them. If Condon has five teachers in their elementary school, there aren't enough teachers to teach every subject that has to have a certified, highly qualified teacher for that subject. So I could see them contracting for that fifth grade math class.
Well, let's come back to this after we take the public testimony and as we move into the deliberation of the task force later this afternoon, and maybe we can follow up a little bit offline as well. Senator Devlin?
Ms. Reagan, to my right here, just pointed out, and we've had this discussion before, that in the final section of this bill, prior to the actual, not Section 8, but Section 7, in the recommendations to the Board of Education, there's a sentence in subsection B, the study must include a recommendation for whether virtual public charter schools should be required to admit part-time students and how those students should be funded. The reason I bring that forward is because I think that's one of the questions that has to be answered before you could have that, because there is no, how would you actually, well, you can have an agreement between the virtual charter school and the school district to fund it, but there is no mechanism for funding it now in state law on a part-time basis. And I think there's a further discussion here, probably with the virtual charter schools that do exist, because we had this discussion whether they should be required, you know, to entertain part-time students. So I think some of those issues are going to be addressed there, but I guess we can just probably wait for additional comments. But the issue still is out there, though, is there would be no restrictions on them actually contracting with a private vendor, just with a virtual charter school would might affect their cap right now.
Are there further burning questions before we move on to the public testimony? Mr. Glaze.
Just a clarification on language. As I'm reading through this, page 3, line 17, it talks about a plan to conduct school-sponsored optional educational events at least 6 times each school year at locations selected to provide convenient access to all students. And then if you drop down to 23, a plan to provide opportunities for face-to-face meetings between teachers and students enrolled in the school at least 6 times each school year. Are we talking about one and the same thing, or are we talking about two different things, and is it optional or is it required? That, those are the questions that pop out in my mind as I read through that.
Okay.
Co-chairs, Mr. Glaze, I would say that these are two different things. The face-to-face meetings would be something such as, this is how you are progressing in your classes, and this is what you need to do to continue to progress. The optional educational events may be more of a social gathering so that the okay. students can interact and have that aspect of the educational experience. Both of these kind of run into that same problem of it's a plan instead of a very clear directive. Mm-hmm. I would say that since it is a plan, it is required, but definitely that language could be stronger to make it more of you must do this, mm-hmm. and that is something that we can consider.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to clarify that actually is current law that's not being changed by this bill.
We maybe can make it better, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of folks in the room, and sometimes I have discussions with folks that are interested in things, and in terms of distinguishing what's current law and what's new, everything that's bold is what's new and what's being proposed to be changed. If it's in italics, that's what's being taken out, and if it's just plain type, that's existing law that doesn't have any proposed change to it. So as you're coming up to testify, as you think about the proposals, that's how to sort that out. Are there any further burning questions before we move on to the public testimony? If there are none, we are going to take just a 2-minute organizational break. So don't go away, just 2 minutes. So we are in recess for about 2 minutes. We're the Online Learning Task Force, and we'll come back to order. So we have a number of people that have signed up to testify today. For the most part, we're going to take people that have come from far away first, but Morgan Allen from the department has to leave the building before 9 o'clock. So we're going to invite Morgan up first. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Co-Chair Gelser and members of the task force. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Department of Education. and have come to provide a few comments on the latest draft of LC 15. The first thing I would mention, too, is that Cindy Hunt, a member of your committee, has already put together some general comments from the department. I believe the committee members should have copies of those that are more technical, cleanup-type things to the original statute in LC 15. But what I really want to focus in on today is Section 6 of LC 15, which directs the board to study and provide recommendations back to legislative committees. And I will make it clear that I'm not here speaking on behalf of the State Board of Education, but want to make a few general comments and then focus in on a couple parts of Section 6. As far as general comments go, I would like to remind this task force that the State Board of Education has taken some pretty significant budget cuts. As Board Director Squire, a member of your task force, can attest to, they've reduced their number of yearly meetings and now only have one full-time staff person, an administrative person, much like Ms. Richardson, who organizes the board meetings and puts together the information. So the department is left to provide research and staffing assistance to the State Board, and that would probably befall our agency to help with these various studies. And I would respectfully remind this task force that the Department of Education has taken significant budget and staffing cuts as well, and our capacity is much reduced to do work as far as that goes. So based on our past experience, and I think you have several of your committee members that have been involved with this, Representative Dembro, Board Member Squire, and Cindy Hunt, I can assure you that between State Board members and Department of Education staff, just dealing with the waivers, for example, entailed literally, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, literally hundreds of hours of staff and board time, meetings, subcommittees, hearings, drafting materials, doing research, etc. So that's sort of a long-winded way of saying that I think legislative concept 15 as it's currently written would create a pretty significant workload issue for the State Board of Education and the Department of Education, and that's fine as long as the legislature and the committee are able to find resources, and frankly those would be financial resources to help provide staffing and other materials for the board. And just to kind of give a sense, you know, I could essentially see almost three task force level subcommittees of the board that would entail a lot of work. There's requirements in there that the board consider funding, governance, special education. The board would probably not be able to tackle those at their full board meetings and instead would likely appoint subcommittees to deal with that, and as they've done on other issues related to virtual charter schools. So I would also say, and Representative Dembro or Board Director Squire could correct me if I'm wrong, that the State Board, a lot of the things in Section 6, the State Board did consider dealing with and tried to tackle in their white paper that that this committee has received. And frankly, I don't think it would be, again, an exaggeration to say that they decided not to tackle some of those issues, frankly, because of time and resource issues, that they felt like there may not be resources or time to deal with those. So, again, I think resources would be a consideration for the State Board and the Department to undertake what I think are some pretty significant tasks and workload. And then specifically on subsection 6, I'd just like to point out a couple of things. So on page 8, section 6, lines 22 and 23, it directs the State Board of Education to generally develop a governance model for virtual public charter schools. And one thing that I would just remind the committee is that presupposes that the legislature and the State Board would still like the virtual school model to be run through the charter school statutes. That's a question that you guys might want to address, whether that is still how you want them to be addressed, or whether it sort of boxes the board into work within the charter school statutes when they're developing this governance model and other things. And so the board has already asked that question, you know, is this the appropriate place? Is charter school law the appropriate place to address how online charter schools are governed? So that's something that this task force should consider. And then sub D, which is lines 30 and 31, ensuring that there's competition among providers of educational services. I think it's fair to say that the board could certainly develop a process, a fair process, or a fair facilitation process, but this may need additional spelling out by legislative counsel, because I'm not sure that the State Board has authority to regulate private enterprise or force vendors to bid. For example, if you know, it was decided that the only fair way to ensure competition is that if a school district is interested in opening a virtual online charter school, that they had to have a bidding process similar to a construction bond or something else that a school district enters into, it's possible that no vendors or one vendor would bid for that. So, you know, I think we just need to clarify, you know, how detailed do you want the board getting into regulating the relationship of sort of private enterprise versus school board. So, you know, legislative council and other folks could obviously look at how things for other portions in public school law are addressed in that, but that was just one thing that just seemed a little bit vague on first reading for us. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, Cindy Hunt has submitted written comments related to the Senate Bill 767 statute and other things. So again, I appreciate the opportunity to testify early today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Commissioner Devlin.
I wanted to basically make a few comments and just ask for clarification here. Section 6, I think one of the difficulties in Section 6 is we probably do need to do some clarification of some of the language here because it's a little bit confusing. But it all should be read in light of subsection A. When you read all the large A, B, C, D, it should all be read in the light of A. And I think some people are reading it more broadly than A, because it's talking about within virtual charter school providers there. I would highlight, though, that in this particular area, the board has already done a great deal of work and probably just needs to reach out more to stakeholders before it would come back to the legislature and to decide what direction they would like to recommend to the legislature. B and C do not have specific dates to come back. And if the Department of Education, for some reason, didn't have the resources to do that, I think that's one of the things that they could actually present in terms of budget packages in the 2011 section, that they would need to address those. So I think, and obviously Section 2 is not the responsibility of the board in that section, subsection 2. Well, it is, that one is the responsibility to present it. But I see this in terms of immediate direction to the board would be to develop that governance model and bring it back to the 2011 session. The other two, B and C, do not have specific dates to bring back. And if the Board of Education and the Department of Education decided they didn't have resources, it would seem reasonable that they would propose during the budgetary process that they need additional resources to do those items.
Are there further comments or questions?
I might, if
yes,
I may.
Ms. Squire.
I will say that in my discussions with the other board members at the time that I was appointed to this committee, and in our discussions during board meetings while we were doing the white paper, the board, all of the board members considered the governance issue to be key to solving a lot of other problems. And I think that this is a task that the board would embrace. That is not to minimize what Morgan is saying about the need for department resources, but we have done a good deal of this work, and our leanings, I think, are clear. So perhaps one of the things that would be helpful to move that along would be if there are some leanings in the board's white paper that do not meet with the approval of those who would be doing the legislating, would be good for us to know that. One of the things I would point out is that the board's white paper makes clear that we do not believe that the current charter school laws are the best venue for governing virtual education. We see a number of the problems that we're trying to address here arising from the mixing of the virtual charter school laws, I mean, the charter school laws and virtual education. So that's just by way of sort of giving a picture into some of the discussions that we had as we developed the white paper.
Thank you.
I those comments are helpful. I was trying to reconcile a little bit the comments, recognizing the budgetary difficulties with letters and communications I had from the Department of Ed last spring as we considered 767 that seemed to be, let us do this work. We don't want you to do the work. We want you to do the work. But I hear the concern about the budgetary resources, and I think that's a challenge that we have across the state and the legislative body as well, where we have a legislative assembly that operates on a shoestring, and we too have no full-time policy person that can do research. So that's a challenge in however we put it together. Are there any further comments or questions?
Just one.
Yeah, Mr. Glaze.
One thing that we might want to keep in mind is, and it may be appropriate under Section 6, I don't know, but in public education, we're required to, when we purchase textbooks, we're required to purchase textbooks that have gone through a quality control process to make sure that those textbooks meet certain state guidelines and standards. And it does seem to me that somewhere in this process, there should be some quality control put into play, where we are assuring that the online education curriculum that's provided to students meets some criteria and standards that have been examined and looked at in the same manner as textbooks are for public education. It does seem to me that that piece of monitoring needs to be addressed at some point in some place in this.
Okay. Thank you. Any further comments before we let Morgan get to his meeting?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going to your concern about the line about competition, we did talk last time about looking at a kind of RFP process, you know, so that districts would not do single source vendors but would engage in an RFP process. And I don't know, I should have asked you this, Hannah, when you were up there, if that's what this this part of the LC is reflecting, is that desire. But that's something maybe we can talk about when we have our conversation after the testimony.
I think that makes sense. Yes.
Let me just ask a bit of a procedural question because I'm a little bit confused about what this committee is going to come out with. So, for example, in Section 7, it says the appropriate legislative committee of the 76th Legislative Assembly shall evaluate whether the previous, and that language is fine, but if we're recommending that they look at that, the question is the task force separately going to be providing specific recommendations on that topic to the committee? I mean, this seems pretty wishy-washy, given all the work that we've all done together. If there seems to be a clear sense from Department of Ed and there seems to be a general sense from this committee that online learning should be separated from charter school law, are we going to be coming out with something more forceful for this, or is this our opportunity to make that statement?
I think that there's two challenges, and my co-chair can correct me if I hit it the wrong way. One, what this task force is charged with is bringing forward a legislative proposal for February. And I think in our discussions, especially in our small group work, there was general consensus that that it wasn't a good fit to have all of our online learning within the charter statute.
Right.
But there was also some consensus that we probably couldn't figure out how to do that the right way and break apart those statutes.
Agreed.
In time for the drafting deadlines for February to do it in a way that was appropriate. The other challenge that we have is, and what we're really doing as a task force is putting a stake in the ground saying this is something that needs to be considered doing forward, trying to operate within the parameters that we can't actually tell a future legislature what to do,
right,
nor can we tell them what bill to pass. Otherwise, we would be suggesting a bill. So what this is essentially doing is saying relatively strongly, as far as our process goes, we really recommend that the legislature, moving forward, look at this issue.
And I guess I'm just trying to figure out whether shall evaluate is strong enough, or gives enough guidance as to where this task force came down. Because, you know, to me, this just says, yeah, we ought to look at it, as opposed to here's what, you know, the task force really believed. And so,
there is a missing element in this, actually, and that is not in this draft. But Ms. Richardson is working on the report to the education committees that are required under 767.
and you'll probably see that sometime soon. And I think in that report, there's been a lot of discussion about whether this particular chapter of ORS should be split apart.
Right.
And that's being explained, I believe, in that report, that the committee has found that there are some inherent difficulties in trying to talk about virtual charter schools and talk about charter schools. And when you're trying to change anything in that chapter, are you applying it just to virtual charter schools, or are you applying it to all charter schools? And I think that's going to be pointed out, actually, in terms of the committee discussion in the report to the education committees. And
okay, that's helpful. So we're going to have this, plus we'll have a report.
Right.
Thank you.
Great. Are there any further burning questions directed towards Morgan at this point?
Burning.
Seeing none, thank you very much.
Burning in the Department of Education.
So our next panel will be, and you can choose which order you want to go in if you've all worked it out among yourselves, Mark Scarborough, Cindy McGraw, Tracy Holthausen, Preston Baxter, and Paula Foster.
Before we get started, I have a letter from the Oregon Virtual Public Schools.
Can you wait? Because just for the process, we have to have you introduce yourselves first for the record.
Okay.
But if you have handouts, you can give them to Ian, and he'll get them to all of us right now. But maybe you can kick off with the introduction.
Sure.
Does that work?
I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you.
It's okay.
And then before you each start, if you can just state your name for the record. You don't have to give your address or anything, just your name.
I don't want to hide you. Yes, since I jumped the gun, I'll go first. My name is Cindy McGraw. I'm from Canby, Oregon. I have a daughter that's a sixth grader in the Oregon Virtual Academy. The letter that I handed the gentleman is from the Oregon Public Virtual Schools Alliance, and they've requested that letter be distributed to all task members and be a part of the record today. Thank you.
Yes.
Task force members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I appreciate the work you've done, and I know that this is a difficult situation for everybody involved on your side as well as ours. I would like to address the number of contacts required to comply with the virtual school guidelines. We meet in virtual class once a week. This meeting is conducted by our teacher and gives us an overview of the week, the month, and reviews any pertinent issues applicable to any upcoming events, tasks, etc. All in attendance have the opportunity to ask and have questions answered. We then have a second contact via a weekly question addressed to my daughter. Recently, we have begun a voluntary third contact via our Wednesday workshops, which review our previous math strand and gives Lacey the opportunity to ask questions and work additional problems pertaining to the previous math strand. I know that's kind of vague, but basically we get a math strand once a week that pertains to their grade level. We work it independently and then meet in this workshop, and the kids are instructed in it through the teacher, and then they'll retest it again or have the option to retest. It is my opinion that this two mandatory contacts per week are satisfactory. I, at any and all times, feel I can contact Lacey's teacher with regard to any questions I may have as a learning coach, and certainly regarding any questions or problems Lacey may be having regarding her studies. This available contact is not limited to questions and answers, but also the opportunity to literally work problems or receive further instruction in a topic. I appreciate the minimum two contacts per week and feel that requiring more contacts per week will take away from the valuable time I spend with my daughter. The contact minimum is perfect because for those that are progressing with no problem, it allows them to continue to move forward and make best use of their time. For those of us that may be having difficulty progressing forward, it gives us a nice baseline of contact, but yet we are able and as needed to contact our teacher at any time and get a prompt response, allowing us to keep moving forward with our studies and make the best use of our time. One of the keys to the virtual programs is the flexibility to suit the varied needs of different students. Some need more contact, while others need just the minimum, so depending on the individual, it's perfect. Please consider keeping the contact requirements as they are and support us in moving our virtual school programs and our children's learning opportunities forward. Just briefly, I want to mention the six required face-to-face contacts that they're talking about adding. We have to think about the children that are in this program because they're homebound due to medical reasons. Those face-to-face meetings you know, in my opinion, would probably be something where we go on a certain day, kind of like our outings, and meet face-to-face with our teachers, kind of like we do in the public schools where we have, like, group report card readings, like in the middle school right now. My son, we go and we all go into the gym and we take a number and line up and go through and meet their teachers. So I'm kind of thinking it would be along that lines, just because it would be difficult for the teachers, especially because of the vast geography of where their students are located. It's really not practical. So in us traveling to a single location, you have to keep in mind, too, that could create hardships on families as well, not only financially but time-wise. In closing, I also want to momentarily express my personal disappointment and anxiety over the fact that there was no headway made in the areas of access and certainty with regard to the virtual programs. We are once again left in a state of flux, not knowing where Lacey's education stands for the future. Please know, however, that we will continue to push ahead. I just find it unfortunate that the legislature's inability to tackle some of these issues after being asked to do so on behalf of taxpayers' dollars has resulted in so many issues left unresolved. I do appreciate the work you've done, and I do thank you for your time.
Thank you. And maybe we'll go through the whole panel and then do questions at the end of the panel if people have them.
Chair Gelser, Chair Devlin, members of the task force, good morning. My name is Mark Scarborough. I am a virtual school parent, a learning coach for three children. I also serve as a volunteer on the Oregon Connections Academy Parents Association Board. Not because I have so much time on my hands, but because I feel it's really, really important that there be a voice for those of us, our little 1% of the student population that are out there pioneering. It's my hope that our students will be among those pioneers who complete their entire K-12 education through the virtual school system. It's been just a fantastic opportunity. Two of our kids have not had any other form of schooling, so this is all that they understand as schooling, and it's very difficult to explain to them why there's an issue about whether their school may exist next year or may not exist next year. And I think that the point is well taken, that it's very difficult for us as parents to not know whether our school will be available next year, and not because it's not performing. Our school has actually performed outstandingly well. It's performed very well for our kids. And also, I think the flexibility of virtual schooling is really key, and to the point of these mandated contacts, we have three kids, and that may not be thought of as this language is prepared, that for a family with multiple children, it may be very, very difficult for each one of them to have several events that they must attend that aren't necessarily the same events at the same time. So I'd like to ask you to bear that in mind as you come up with wording to govern those kinds of things. And I'm very happy to be here today to contribute to the discussion of virtual schooling, because we do have we're going into our fifth year of experience with this new model, and it is very different. It's not the same as homeschooling. It's not the same as a brick-and-mortar school, but it is definitely a valid option for public education that is beneficial in a lot of different ways. And I have to confess that I've kind of become frustrated with the process of governance that takes into account so many other things, but not really about what's happening and the education. As I said, our school has met AYP. It has received an outstanding rating. It's just proven itself over and over again. And I'd like you to try to imagine what it's like to juggle the responsibilities of a learning coach for three kids, a full-time job. My wife works a part-time job. I'm our primary learning coach. So we do a lot of learning in the evenings or on the weekends, and catch up on holiday breaks and so on. And then on top of that, to be constantly monitoring this process, sending emails, coming down to the Capitol, spending hours to spend a three-minute presentation, and all just to point out the obvious, that virtual schooling is successful. There is a need for it. It isn't for every student in the state, but it is definitely a valid form of schooling, and we would ask that you would move to protect that so that it will be an available option. One of the concerns also is that in all of this, with the current LC, it looks like we're looking at assurances that we don't want to close a virtual school that's successful, but at the same time that we're not having a whole lot of progress, and that we're not going to know whether we have a 2011-12 school year until pretty close to the deadline to start the school, and that causes a lot of unnecessary stress. So in closing, I'd like to say that traditional brick-and-mortar schools will probably likely continue to be a choice for the majority of the public because it is very demanding to be a virtual school family. But we would really appreciate it if you would take us into account when you put together the legislation to protect us and not to impose undue restrictions on virtual schooling in the future in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to go to the other table. Okay. Chair Devlin, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. Hello, my name is Paula Foster, and I'm from Hillsboro, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on virtual learning in Oregon, of which I have personal experience, and I'm very passionate about, not only for my children, but for all of the children in Oregon. This is my fifth year with Oregon Connections Academy, and we have five children currently attending. ORCA has improved each year, as evidenced by my personal experience, annual audits of the school, and the recent state report card rating it outstanding. When we started ORCA, we had the high-quality teachers and excellent textbooks, consumables, and online curriculum. This still hasn't changed. But ORCA, over the past 3 years, has listened to the students, teachers, leadership team, parents, and other key stakeholders, and made improvements, including, one, weekly live lessons offered in each subject area with our highly qualified teachers, parent volunteer community coordinators that plan ORCA outings for more local community contact, more offerings for us to visit with our teachers face-to-face, and the creation of performance status smiley face icons, which allows the kids to be more aware of their progress. We are incredibly happy with ORCA and with the progress our kids are making. Our kids are independent, disciplined, happy. My husband and I are more organized, self-motivated, and aware. Our administrators and teachers know our needs and are able to provide for us. I don't understand the need to change or restrict what we have. I've been told if something isn't broken, don't fix it. Why fix it? It's frustrating when I, as many as well as others, have spent countless hours working as part of this legislative process, and this continuing on until February or beyond, I just see a lot of precious time wasted. It's simple. ORCA knows how to produce results. Allow ORCA and other highly qualified and accountable virtual public schools to keep producing those results with the rules and regulations that are in place right now, and regulate as the need arises, or better yet, allow the agency that was created to oversee public schools do the regulating. It would save a lot of time for everyone and provide stable educational environment for many families that are affected and involved. So finally, I would like you to know the impact that SB 767 had when it passed. I was in the gallery, and as soon as the gavel hit the desk, there were tears in my eyes. My parents were sent to move to Oregon, and all that had to fall into place was for my niece to have placement in a virtual school. They needed the individualized learning plan, and for her to have the flexibility that a virtual school had to offer her. Long story short, they ended up staying in California because the caps here in Oregon didn't allow her in. They managed to have the option of two virtual schools in California, but none in Oregon because of the 50-50 rule and the enrollment caps. When decisions and recommendations are made, it may not only affect students in our state, but those families that are seeking to live and work in our beautiful state. So please do not fix what is working well with our children. Thank you for your time and for learning about virtual learning. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Tracy Holthausen, and I'm here to share how ORCA has changed our lives and our son's future. ORCA has saved our son from being subjected to violence, profanity, physical restraining, and time in a padded room. ORCA has saved our son from a future 12-year education consisting of being passed from one grade to another with little expectation as to what my child would accomplish academically. This is a strong statement, but a true one. This is just a little piece of the journey my family and I have been on for the last 7 years. Now let me help you understand what life is like for a family with a special needs child and how ORCA has changed our lives. I am mother of two amazing children. My daughter Trinity is 10 years old and in fifth grade. She attends Pleasant Valley Elementary School in the Centennial School District. My son Maximus is 7 years old and in the second grade he attends ORCA. From a young age, Maximus was different. We had our child tested through Multnomah County. He did indeed have deficits. We were given numerous diagnoses from multiple specialists. pervasive developmental disorder, ADHD, ODD, sensory integration disorder, and many other labels. At this time, Maximus attended a supportive preschool through Multnomah Early Childhood Program. When it was time to transition to kindergarten, we were told kindergarten at Pleasant Valley Elementary would be the best place, but soon everything came crashing down. We found that teachers and aides required very little training for children with special needs. We started questioning the school system. The system does not like to be questioned. Our time from our son was soon being sucked by meeting after meeting, lawyers, school specialists, and trying to understand the school system. Ultimately, we were given the school's final decision, a behavioral class with a padded room and permission for restraining. At this time, my son was 5, and this was the only option for the school district. We soon came to the realization this kind of classroom would not be an option. I want to share with you our Orva experience and how this system of teaching has enabled us to give our son an education that far exceeds what would be offered at a brick and mortar. When we permanently pulled Maximus out of the brick and mortar, it was 4 months into his first grade year. When we viewed Orva's extensive curriculum, we asked ourselves, would our child be able to learn so much? The answer, yes. He was finally challenged. Due to Orva's flexibility, we continued a full-time curriculum throughout the summer, and we were able to complete his whole first grade year. The curriculum Orva brings to the table is amazing. We are able to teach him at a rate that suits him. When we pulled him from the brick and mortar, he was not reading at grade level. Approximately 6 months later, he was reading at grade level and spelling at grade level. He is now able to pick up a book and read to himself. 2.5 months into this school year, he is almost halfway through his math curriculum. Orva will then allow my son to move on to the third grade curriculum without phone calls and numerous meetings. Orva also allows my husband and I to teach my son in an environment that is conducive to our child's needs. He's easily distracted and frustrated. He requires numerous breaks with a very low stimulus environment. There are some days when Maximus has intense meltdowns and is unable to complete the day's schoolwork. This behavior happens and is not uncommon in children with his neurological challenges. Because of Orva, we do not have to worry. He's in a safe, supportive environment, and he will not miss the full days of instruction. We have the ability to make up the lessons later in the week or even on weekends when he is able to focus. In his brick and mortar, he would completely miss out on a day of instruction and fall further and further behind. Given the flexibility of Orva, Maximus can attend private therapy without disruption to his daily educational needs. Maximus's teacher has been only an email or a phone call away. She has responded almost immediately and is very supportive of our challenge. Orva and my child's brick-and-mortar school, Harold Oliver Elementary, have come together to form an IEP that is now very supportive of my son and his needs. Maximus is able to attend Orva and is able to see a speech pathologist, psychologist, therapist, and behavioral support specialist once a week at his brick-and-mortar. This is proof the two systems can work together to help these children reach their maximum potential. It can be done. It comes down to the children. Not every child is the same. We all know this. But let us act on this and support different ways of education. You can change these children's lives by allowing them a future. Do not allow these children to be shuffled along in a system that does not support their true potential as future productive citizens. I implore you, allow Orva to continue their amazing service to my child and all other children. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser, Chair Devlin, and the members of the task force, thank you once again for allowing this direct public input. My name is Preston Baxter. I live in Independence, Oregon. I am the father of 6 children, 4 of whom are currently enrolled in the ORCA program starting this year. I appreciate the opportunity to tell you a little bit about my son, Colton, who's here with me today, and his recent experience with online public charter education. I would have loved to tell you his whole story, but I understand we're strapped for time, so we'll summarize 6 years in about 3 minutes here. His challenges started before birth and include many medical miracles, genetic testing, many specialists, and loving caregivers at every step. A partial list of his special needs and challenges include physical and cognitive developmental delays, multiple ear infections and partial hearing loss, speech therapy, nervous system stimulation or tactile therapy that needs to be conducted every 2 hours, ongoing monitoring by specialists at Dornbecker's Children's Hospital, is pediatrician, occupational therapist, multiple massage therapists, hearing specialists, ENT team, and et cetera, many others. Initial evaluations by the local school district resulted in early intervention services at a local preschool, in-home visits, occupational and speech therapy on a regular basis. We were more than happy with the support of the teachers and staff in preparing Colton for what he called big school. However, Colton's kindergarten year was a struggle. Therapy services were cut drastically, even while many of his specialists were insisting that therapy should instead be increased. He struggled in a large and noisy classroom due to his partial hearing loss. He started having significant emotional outbursts, which were linked to his genetic disorder and a lack of regular occupational and tactile therapy. Subsequent testing showed that he was unable to retain many of the skills that were taught during his kindergarten year. And then we were disappointed that Colton's IEP for first grade called for only 4 hours of observation and other services. That was 4 hours for the entire year. To meet his therapy needs, directed by his many specialists, we decided to pursue online virtual public education to afford us the flexibility in his schedule, help mitigate the effects of his hearing loss by providing a single student class size, and take advantage of an opportunity to conduct an accelerated do-over of Orca's kindergarten curriculum with the goal of also completing his first grade this school year. These benefits would not have been possible in our local school. After only a few months, Colton is flourishing once again. To get through his curriculum efficiently, Colton's mother and I split the coaching duties and help at different times of the day. Many of the challenges he faced during the previous school year have been mitigated now that we're part of a very flexible, customized, and still rigorous curriculum. We understand that Colton's special needs are unfamiliar to the local school district since his condition could not even be diagnosed until only a few years ago. I suspect that there are many students like Colton and Maximus with very specific and specialized needs that may not be typical or well understood or fully supported. But through ORCA, our family has found a great way for him to succeed in public education. It's my hope that this option continues to be available to Colton, other students and families throughout Oregon who can benefit in the ways that my son has. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments for this panel? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Is there anything about LC-15 or what we've been discussing this morning or up to this point that makes you feel that Lacey's opportunity might go away with Oregon Connections Academy? And what if you could specify for me, because I want to make sure that we're not interrupting Lacey's education or others that are already enrolled.
Okay, thank you. And just a quick overview. I've been with this since the very beginning, since you guys started, since the SB 767 came on board. I testified in front of the House Revenue Committee last year. I was available at most of the meetings. Lacey and I did a demonstration, an online demonstration for some folks. So mine was brief and targeting just a few specific things because I feel like I'm part of the family. I mean, I've been here since the beginning. So every year it's a question, and I'll be completely honest with you, Representative Huffman, and I'm not saying this to be disrespectful, but my contacts with senators and state representatives have made it very clear, and I'm sorry that I get emotional, that a large portion of this is about money and who pays who. I have been told that regardless of how certain people feel, they will vote in favor of who the group that gives them the money for their campaigns wants them to vote. To me, this has been a very disheartening procedure. In fact, one time I almost turned around halfway down here and went home. I'm a legal U.S. citizen. I pay my taxes. And coming down here that one time in the spring, I thought, I have nothing to offer these people. I can't give them money for their campaign. I can't promise them future re-election. But my issue is that I have a child that has a learning disability, and we have struggled through public and private school to find a way to get her caught up. That's finally working with ORVA. I think the biggest thing, I work in the medical field. The biggest thing is I am a public layperson. Half of the stuff I read, you guys, I do not understand. It's vague. I come to meetings, I hear one thing, and I think I've understood something else. It's extremely difficult. And just the unknown makes you feel like every year we're sitting in the same boat. I do not know if this program is going to be available in the future. You tell me it is. You know, the people that I work with through the Alliance, even the teachers in my school, they say that next year we're okay on board. there can be no additional enrollment. There's caps. There's all these restrictions. I just try to stay focused on the fact that I'm trying to get Lacey from point A to point B. Eventually, she wants to re-enroll in public school. She sees her friends, but she misses her friends. Actually, she sees her friends more than she did when she was in regular school. She's involved in a lot of school activities and stuff. But the bottom line is, I just try to stay focused on getting her to where she needs to be. And I just hope and pray that along the way, you guys see the need for this program, for these children that have these varied needs. It may be a short-term need. It may be a full 12-year need. I can't say what that is. And I know this is very difficult because there are so many variables, so many people to make happy. There's a shortage in finances. I know just even in our public school system, our particular school, 91 School in Canby, we have a horrendous number of volunteers that volunteer hours to keep things moving forward in that school because we don't have the money that we used to have. But coming back to the Lacey issue, yes, Representative Huffman, every year I wonder, even though I'm told it will be here next year, if it will truly be here next year, which creates a tremendous amount of strength, stress and anxiety for both me and for her, because now she's feeling that stress again of I have to hurry up and figure this out, or I'm just going to get thrown back into school and I'm going to flunk again. So, yes, I think because of the way that things are written and the fact that we are lay people, it's very difficult to know for sure, and the history of our government, and I'm sorry, I don't mean that derogatorily. I know you guys do a lot of work and do a lot of hard work, but you each have your own interests that you have to represent. I'm here just to represent my daughter's interests. Honestly, I don't care who pays you. I don't care what goes on. I just need to know that I have a way to get my daughter graduated from high school. Whether that's through virtual school or integrating back into public school with the help of virtual school, I don't know what that answer is right now. We're just taking it a day at a time.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate you being here and being involved. Can I ask the co-chairs a question? Is there anything that we're doing that she should be concerned that Lacey is going to lose?
Can I?
Yeah.
Thank you. I think that certainly in the letters that we've received a lot, and I talked to Ms. Kramer about this last week as well, I get it that there is significant concern out there that school, that people are nervous about whether their school will even be open next year. There is nothing in LC 15 that would close ORVA or would close ORCA next year. And I think to the contrary, what you see in here is the fix to protect the enrollment of ORVA moving forward, as we talked about last time. I think the other thing that you see in here, that you had raised the question, Mr. Scarborough, about not knowing until July 1st of 2011. So many numbers. Until July 1st of 2011, whether or not a waiver would be granted. What you see in here is that ability for the department to receive those waiver applications and consider them so that it's not all the way at July 1st, 2012, to provide some sense of what it is that's going, of what it is that's going on moving forward. I think that I don't know about anybody else at this table, but I can certainly appreciate the exhaustion with this process and the moving forward and the many questions. I doubt that there's anyone that's been involved in this process that doesn't share that sense of this is a big project and it's a lot to unravel. I also think that it is about not about money and campaigns. It's about governance and how do we put these pieces together so that we know that when Lacey goes to school, it continues to be a high-quality school. How do we make sure that any new programs that come on offer the same high quality that you've experienced for Lacey? It's not about shutting you down. It's about providing an appropriate governance structure, and that's not code for shutting you down. It truly is about creating an appropriate governance structure.
Thank you, Representative Gelzer. I would agree with everything Representative Gelzer has said. In addition to that, I would point out that about a week or 10 days ago, when Representative Gelzer and I were meeting over looking where the discussions had been here, we discovered an issue and have tried to address it. And that is that the issue is that the way the bill was originally written, now people could have differences of opinion how they want it rewritten, but the way it was originally written, existing programs in particular like ORCA and ORVA would not have been able to approach the Board of Education in terms of starting the process for a waiver until basically July of 2011. We recognize that that would basically make it very difficult for those programs to continue, so that's why we put the language in this draft so that they could start that process and get some clear indications of their ability to potentially, or their ability to continue in the forthcoming year under a waiver, because unless we had included that within the draft, there could have been a question out there about whether or not the board could have even started considering the process for a waiver till July 1st, 2011.
Thank you. I want to interject one final thing. I appreciate your confidence in the program. It does give me a sense of ease. It's not just about you guys. It's about the other entities that are involved. And I think there's a misunderstanding about this program and the amount of time and commitment it takes on a parent's behalf to make this work. It's the biggest undertaking I've ever taken on in my life. You know, I've gone to college. I've had a family. But this is huge. I mean, it takes a lot out of me. It takes a lot from our family, but it's also helped us grow closer as a family. And Lacey is flourishing. Her self-esteem and her character is stronger than it's ever been. So the little items that get nitpicked, like the 6 times a year face-to-face meetings, and the little details that keep getting added in or that outside groups want written into the language. Until you've walked in my shoes, you don't know what that entails. It takes everything that I have to get us through the program we're working with right now. We have made improvements every year. This is our second year. It's huge this year compared to last year. I'm so satisfied with the curriculum and the way the program runs. I do not feel like creating the hardship of adding 6 additional face-to-face meetings, you know, throughout the school year is necessary. I see those as additional hurdles that people are throwing in front of us that make it more and more difficult for us to keep moving forward with this program.
And I should clarify, that is not proposed in the there's not that's
right,
current that's current law
plan.
That has
right.
That's what's currently been in the law. There isn't a change.
Right, but I want
there.
You guys to understand that those additional little things that are written in, I don't think change the quality of the education that my child is receiving. It only poses additional hardships for us as learning coaches. You know, and my daughter said to me, well, why can't we look at them on webcam? She said, I don't know that I would learn anything more by having a face-to-face meeting with my teacher than I learn right now. So this has become a way of life for us, virtual schooling. Corporations do it every day and make billions of dollars meeting with, you know, adjoining offices worldwide, and they don't have to have face-to-face meetings. I just don't think those little things are necessary.
Well, and I think we have a really long list of testimony. I think you all heard that we lose the room at noon, and we have to have time to deliberate. So you have one quick earning. All right.
Relative to this, co-chairs, members of the task force, I think that what we'd also like to do is take this opportunity to look at what the standing law is and say, is this appropriate in this respect also, where you're talking about this mandated 6 times a year contact, maybe does that need some more flexibility? Because the way things that change with technology, I mean, obviously we all communicate way differently than we did 5 years ago. So to set that into law maybe is not the most appropriate way to do it. And since we're looking at how to revise this, not only to revise it to place additional restrictions on virtual schools, but perhaps to look at how those are the existing ones are applying. And secondly, we're all here for our own families because we are dedicated virtual schooling parents, but we also want this opportunity to be available to any Oregon student who would like to do it or any Oregon family who would like to do it. So I would ask you to take that into consideration as well when we talk about the caps and so on.
Great. Thank you. And thank you all very much for taking the time to come today and for working so hard. I know that it takes a lot of work to compress the stories about your kids. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next, Jerry Wilkes from Orca, please. Good morning, members of the Online Learning Task Force. My name is Jerry Wilkes, and this is my third year as the Executive Director of the Oregon Connections Academy. Thank you for giving me a few minutes today to speak on a few issues that are important to me and I know that you are working on. I'm especially honored to be here this morning as the entire nation celebrates American Education Week, the time of year when we especially remember that in this country, all means all. Our doors are open to all children of all people. What an opportunity for the nation's children and for those of us privileged to be educators. I believe with supported data that the Oregon Connections Academy provides an outstanding schooling option for over 2,500 students in grades K through 12 throughout the state of Oregon. I'm very proud of our staff of 69 teachers. They are all highly qualified and licensed through the Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I'm also very proud of our administrative leadership team that consists of me, three assistant principals, a manager of special education services, and a manager of guidance and counseling services. We are all licensed by TSPC. I'm also very proud that the Oregon Connections Academy made AYP this year and most recently earned a rating of outstanding on the Oregon State Report Card that was published publicly on November 10th. I believe that outstanding test results clearly demonstrate that our students are achieving at a high academic level in spite of the fact that 52% of our students qualify for free or reduced lunches and come from diverse backgrounds. One of the areas I know that you're working on is virtual special education services and how virtual schools support students and families. I am very proud of the model we've established at ORCA that provides direct support along with the local district to students and families to address their specific disabilities and individualized academic needs. We currently have 165 students with IEPs and 98 students with 504 plans. We have four licensed special education teachers and a manager of special education services that are members of the local district IEP team. The students are divided by grade level, and the ORCA teachers give direct support to the IEP and/or 504 plans by attending all the IEP meetings and making regular weekly live contacts in addition to the regular education staff contacts by grade, subject level, homeroom, and academic support groups led by teachers. This additional teacher, as a member of the local IEP team, provides one more resource and or contact to address the specific student needs and or accommodations. Also, I'm very proud of the fact that the ORCA Board of Directors supported the hiring of special education staff even though it's not funded. The ORCA model is working as evidenced by the state's own accountability metrics as well as in-depth annual third-party site reviews that we have every year. While we currently do not have to provide designated instruction by state law, our ability to make accommodations and modifications unique to each student is unprecedented because teachers work so closely with students individually. In our program, students receive a great deal of individualized support and planning. I want to thank you again for inviting me today, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Are there any questions for Mr. Wilkes? Yes, Mr. Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkes. I just want to say congratulations. It's more of a comment than anything. Making AYP running 2,500 student enrolled school and meeting virtually every academic achievement requirement, participation in state tests very high, and also meeting your graduation rate. That's a tremendous tremendous task, and I want to compliment you on that.
Thank you, Mr. Lynn.
Thank you. Any further questions? Comments? No, thank you very much, Mr. Wilkes.
You bet.
All right, next we have the number four is Ken Woody, Stephanie Hinkle, and Mary Layton.
Thank you. Ken Woody, Director of Westlane Technical Learning Center at Charters High School, right outside of Eugene.
I'm Mary Layton, Executive Director of Network Charter School in Eugene.
And I'm Stephanie Hinkle. I'm the Director of Trillium Charter School in Portland.
I'm here because we offer online education, but we're not a virtual charter school by definition because we have a physical classroom. We also offer technical classes in auto and electric vehicle. We are concerned, though, that legislation in around the virtual schools will affect us and in some cases already has. I'm a licensed administrator at all levels. I have degrees in journalism, a master in communications, and a doctoral level degree in counseling and human services. My previous job experience, 18 years as a college football coach, 2 years as an athletic director, jobs in student athletic counseling, as principal of Lebanon High School, teacher of drama, writing, language arts, and alternative high school, and director of human resources and organizational development for a trucking company. Our school is Westlane Tech. It's part of the Fern Ridge School District. We have 70 students with room for 120. We need 100 to stay solvent. Most are 1 to 2 years behind in credits for graduation when they come to us. Last year we had 23 graduates, 17 went on to college. 80% of our total students are in online core curriculum. 40% of those students attend physical classroom at least once a week. We have 2 highly qualified teachers in our classroom. We also have 46 students from neighboring Elmira High School who attend career technical classes in our Auto Electric Vehicle Academy at no cost. This is a value of $33,000 per semester. We also have 2 students each from Sheldon and Crow High Schools, schools who drop their auto programs, who attend our auto program at no cost. We have implemented applied mathematics into our auto and electric vehicle classes. We've also implemented credit by proficiency. We have a waiver of the 50-50 percent rule because we are capped within our own district to only 35 students. We are currently involved in a dissemination grant, working with a network charter school and a couple other schools. It's a project. It also includes as many as 2 public high schools, Elmira and Willamette High Schools. The focus is improving math instruction with at-risk high school students who have fallen behind in credits and skills required to pass the traditional high school mathematics pathway. The project will involve selected at-risk students who will attend a 45-minute online class with a teacher in a classroom and improve basic mathematics fundamentals over a semester. They will be map tested through the NWEA, which is aligned with Oregon's OAKS tests. Before and after the class, you see measures of progress and focus on specific skill areas that still may need to be refined. Math was picked as the project focus because it's a pivotal point of failure that prompts kids to become discouraged, give up, become behavioral problems, and head on down the road to dropping out. A significant number of students are behind in math skills before they enter high school because of classroom and personnel limitations at the high school never have a chance to catch up. This project, if successful, may offer our district and others a positive approach to the problem of low mathematics achievement. It is our goal to become experts in cutting-edge math instruction and provide the most creative and effective approaches to improving math achievement for at-risk students in Oregon. Our charter school benefits from the charter law ORS 338, which established a framework free of some limitations that limit the operating potential of public schools. Our commitment is to be creative, innovative, and to take risks in the name of achievement, accountability, assessment, and new approaches to instruction. If successful, they may be applied to other schools and districts on a larger scale. We are the Department of Research and Development for the larger educational organization. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gelser, Senator Devlin, and members of the committee. Thanks for taking the time to work on this important issue.
And would you state your name for the record more time?
Stephanie Hinkle from Trillium Charter School in Portland. We're a brick-and-mortar school. We have 345 approximate students. We also have a private preschool that's part of our community. So we're a fairly large brick-and-mortar school in our state. This is our eighth year of operation, and we have K through 12 at our school. We will have our sixth graduating class this year. At the end of this year, about 39% of our students run free and reduced lunch, and we have a high proportion of special needs students at our school for a brick-and-mortar building that we serve very well. I'm here a little bit to talk about unintended consequences of the discussion around, it's been online charter schools, but in the past, most things don't affect us in some ways. We're at capacity pretty much. We have huge waiting lists, so we don't get very many out-of-district students. So we are kind of insulated from the issues that have come up in the past in this committee about transfers in and all those kind of things, but we've been very involved in the statewide movement for charter schools and recognize the impact on charters in general of the kinds of discussions that have come up in the past around that have come to the discussion about online charter schools but really can potentially affect all charter schools and have consequences that are pretty devastating. Things that have been talked about in the past about having to get permission to do, you know, you have to get inter-district transfers for charter school students, I think is the most frightening to me, because I think it would totally decimate charter schools, because the fundamental value of charter schools is that parents have choice and that families have choice, and it takes the choice away from the parent and gives it to the district. So that's a very frightening prospect for me, because I think it would destroy the charter school movement. Another one that comes up pretty often is the idea of licensure, and it seems to come up every session, and I know that's not in this bill particularly, but I'm sure you'll be talking about it again. And this is, again, something that is pretty difficult for us to deal with. The idea of administrative licensure for a charter school is kind of amusing to me, because my job is actually pretty different than a principal's job. And the things that I need training and support with have nothing to do with what I get in an administrative license. I need a different kind of process. And if we're going to go down that road, then we go down that road with the thought of what those leaders need, because it is not the same thing. It's a nonprofit that I'm managing, not just a school. So it's a very much more complex issue, and the skills that I need are completely different. You also leave out a lot of very qualified leaders that can move into schools if you make licensure an issue. Lots of business leaders, community leaders that have lots to offer. So that's a concern that I have that isn't particularly addressed in this now, in this venue, but has been in the past. I think that defining online schools potentially has an impact on my school. I offer kids some online classes because they need to do credit recovery, or they're having trouble fitting into their schedule the thing that they need. All kinds of reasons. And if that becomes a definition that I offer those, that takes away a tool that I have in my toolkit for my students, and it does nothing to support them. And I just want to be really careful that in the age where our world has become pretty virtual, that we take away those tools, I think is pretty frightening. And the issue of bringing up whether they have to be approved as a set of curriculum brings up a whole other complex level of tasks. Any class that my students do online, any access to any curriculum, will that have to be approved? I think those are unintended consequences that we have to really look at deeply before we just move forward, because it sounds like a good idea. And I think quality is important, but the resources out there are immense, and to limit them based on something that is about how we practice in the past, I think leaves out a lot of flexibility and innovation that charter schools have access to now. I would also like to talk about funding, just because every opportunity that I have in front of you, I'd like to talk about charter school funding, which is inadequate and inequitable, in my opinion. And certainly, if you look at the numbers, that's true. We've received maybe half of what regular schools have. We don't have access to all the funds that are out there for public school. We only have it with very specific funds, and that's not enough. And yet we're still held to the same standards and have to participate in the same kinds of costly items like PERS that make it really a constraint. So, and our teachers are the ones that suffer typically because we can't offer comparative salaries because of our underfunded status. So I'd like to thank you for taking the time, and I appreciate all your effort in this issue.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted to clarify something and maybe ask you and maybe ask the remaining panelists. In 767, 5, subsection B, virtual public charter school does not include a public charter school that primarily serves students in a physical location. I mean, that was our attempt to say basically that it would not apply to a school like yours. But what I'd like, actually, if you could comment on, and I think there's one remaining presenter, is we've talked quite a bit about this, is that having the virtual charter school statute within the charter school statute creates an enormous amount of confusion.
Yes,
if you could comment on splitting the two statutes so that you knew when we were actually discussing charter schools and not...
from my position, it would reduce my anxiety about unintended consequences for brick-and-mortar schools. As far as a statewide movement for charter schools, then I have a little bit of concern that it will dilute the already relatively small pool of advocates for the organization. So it would ease my understanding of the potential attacks I sometimes feel like come for charter schools. But we are a group that needs to stick together because we are attacked, we feel like, on a constant basis. So I'm kind of ambivalent right now about what the right answer toward that is, and I would want to research it more. So, I don't know how you guys feel.
I have to tell you, and I'm afraid this will put me in the Kitty Piercy School.
And can
of
you
over
please start
Mary
with your
Layton Network
Thank
Charter
you.
School? This will put me in the Kitty Piercy School of over connecting with really bad historical examples, but I don't actually have a particularly positive opinion of online charter schools. I'm really old-fashioned. But on the other hand, I keep thinking of the story they tell about Nazis, and they say, well, first they came for those people, and they weren't me, so I wasn't worried. And then they came for the next people, and they weren't me, and I wasn't worried. And, you know, the story goes on and on until finally they're coming for me. I mean, as I said, it's kind of a crazy example in a way, but in another way, every time something comes down from Salem, I think, I've been in public education 40 years serving only highly challenged at-risk students. When did I become the enemy? And that's the theme of my story. And it's kind of got to do with unintended consequences and figuring out that we're all, most of us, on the same team here. But first I'd like to tell you about my school because I want you to hear what we do. And furthermore, I have a doctorate in curriculum and instruction, not in educational administration, and I am a licensed administrator in the state of Oregon, which was not an easy thing to do, even with a PhD, and I still don't know half of the stuff I need to know to be a good charter school principal. So the point that was made earlier is really important to note. I want to tell you a little bit about Network Charter School and to express serious concern over several issues. Again, whether they are in this bill or not, they keep coming up. The first is continued pressure to increase the proportion of licensed staff serving in charter schools. It shows a lack of familiarity with the real benefits of our current arrangements, which work well and pose no threat to licensed teachers. Second, requiring parents to get district permission for their children to go to charter schools restricts the measure of choice the law was intended to provide. Third, adding rules about prompt notification when students transfer to charters would change nothing about the speed of communication, which is motivated by economics. Believe me, I want the kid the day the kid chooses to come. I tell the district because I need the money. We serve the kid whether we get the money or not, but I need the money. And finally, the lack of equitable funding is creating severe hardships on the students and families who opt to address state goals in a public school of choice. We're not very radical, us public school of choice people. We're public schools. Eugene School District 4J chartered a network to provide a free, comprehensive, standards-based program to students in grades 7 to 12. It was founded by a creative, what do you call those guys? an insurance, an actuarian, yes. I mean, you know, who knows? I could never have done it, but he was very imaginative. We enroll up to 150 students. Our cap, not theirs, they let us have 400, and I think they're crazy if they think we could serve 400 kids like ours in one building. This school's this year's student profile is typical. 75% receive free or reduced price meals. 35% receive special education services. This is more than twice as much as any other school in the district. 10% are members of minorities, 4% speak Spanish at home. By charter, students may earn a regular diploma or a GED or design an educational plan to achieve a personal goal. Two-thirds of our teachers are fully licensed in Oregon. Two-thirds of our special ed staff have bachelor's degrees. In the past 2 years, we've had its charter renewed and earned accreditation by NAAS. We are a consortium of six community groups. All of the partners provide programs and services to the whole community as well as to NCS. Their courses cover basic academics and relevant advanced content, both discipline-based, biology, and industry-based, like culinary arts. We address state standards. We offer regular credit. Evergreen Development Network, an independent nonprofit reporting to the NCS board, directs school operations, manages the charter, and provides facility shared by partners. The founders of Network Charter recognize that some students cannot succeed in the big classrooms and efficient knowledge development systems that mainstream schools offer. They need a more personal learning environment where they address the common educational goals with methods embedded in community work. At NCS, students learn from nearby nature how to be good stewards of the land by working in community gardens, restoring native habitats, removing invasive species, helping manage Alton Baker Park. From Mecca, they learn how to transform materials diverted from the waste stream into works of art. From Peace Village, they learn how to use reading, writing, and history for community building and problem solving. From Petite Gourmet, they learn how to feed themselves, their families, and their community. Last week, they fed 400 volunteers who serve meals for the Food for Lane County's dinner programs. At Eugene Glass School, students work with a Venice-trained flamework artist. The students achieve goals required to earn a regular diploma while they are learning how to function as productive members of the community. I'm worried about the licensed staff thing. Now, I don't think there's anybody in the room, I'm willing to meet with them in the hall outside afterwards, who can trump my credentials. I have organized teachers for AFT and NEA. I have taught teacher education courses. I have taught in Chicago, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C., inner city schools. I have done policy research for compensatory education. I believe in the professionalization of teachers. But then there's Wendy on my staff who paid for 6 years of college out of her own pocket because she liked different subjects. She kept getting more and more and more highly qualified. She's not going to borrow any money to go get a license. This is the person you want.
I'm so sorry to interrupt because you're a very dynamic speaker, but you are running out of time.
Okay, two more sentences. If you ask districts for permission, it's like asking a starving person to share their last few grains of rice. The odds of altruism are long. Prompt notification, we always tell people when we got their kids because we want the money. Equitable funding, I have to figure out where to get $2 million to buy a building so my school can move out of its current hovel about to be torn down for urban renewal in downtown Eugene. These are not things that a public school principal should have to do. I know how to help teachers teach kids. That's what I want to be able to do. It's our job to support all students in public schools. To close, we ask simply that you treat us the way you treat the rest of the members of the public education community. We are members of this community.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Senator Devlin.
Can I get a clarification on the record, too? And I understand your discussion about, an opening of the door, so to speak. There is nothing in this draft that applies to bricks and mortar charter schools in terms of licensure, nothing that affects the licensure requirements of bricks and mortar charter schools, nothing that affects the licensure of administrators of bricks and mortar charter schools.
My perspective is, in the beginning of this conversation that started last year,
There was a lot that would. And I appreciate the work you've done to get to the point where we're now not part of that. But it felt like we had to put a lot of work into making that happen.
Okay.
So.
Thank you for that clarification, Senator Devlin. Are there further questions or comments for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much for coming. Next we have Karen Hikes.
Good morning, Chair Gelser, Chair Devlin. My name is Karen Hikes, and I am the Executive Director of the Northwest Center for Educational Options. I apologize up front. I'm on the tail end of a two-week virus, so if I have a coughing fit, please forgive me. This is my first foray out of my house in many days. But I wanted to be here today to talk with the task force and take this opportunity. I've met with most of you one-on-one and talked with these issues over many years, and just want to up front express my appreciation for your work and for taking on the complexity of the issues before you. I really do appreciate where we are today, and just want you to know that. We are the State Charter School Association. We represent the charter schools in this state, and you've just heard from a few of the principals who are part of the charter school arena, just like the online charter schools right now are part of the charter school arena. And there's a lot of always a lot of question about where will the impact be, and we really appreciate your sensitivity to separating online charter school issues from brick and mortar charter school issues at this stage. We really do appreciate that you have taken that input to heart with this current legislative concept. So in terms of this concept, we are generally supportive of all the provisions in it, with maybe a couple little exceptions. So I could walk through them all, but basically I want you to know that we are supportive of the concept. A couple minor things. I don't see it in the concept, but I know it was part of your conversation at your last meeting, and I have heard reference of it today. The whole public procurement process for selecting vendors to provide online education. And I don't know if that's a path you're going to go down or not, but just wanted to provide some food for thought on that in terms of the nature, how complex that might be given the nature of the chartering process, because you probably know that a charter developer becomes a nonprofit at some point in their development, but often not until they're open. They become a legal entity as they're developing, Oregon Nonprofit Corporation, but they don't become a 501c3 corporation and probably until they're open. The IRS takes 6 to 18 months to make that determination. Usually a charter developer knows exactly what their model is, and they put it in the proposal to the district. So I guess my question would be, if this procurement process would be used, you know, the contract would need to be between the charter school and the provider, not the district and the provider, because the district isn't running the school. The charter school is running the school. So how could the charter school write its proposal, for instance, you know, for a virtual school if they don't know the nature of the provider? They don't know who that is, because that curriculum, that provider, shapes so much of the educational program. So that's just some food for thought. I'm not saying we're opposed to that notion of using public procurement, but I think there would need to be some thought given to that and some parameters given to that to make sure that it could happen at the right stage in the process and that it wouldn't impede the development of the charter school and the chartering process with the proposal, and the district approves the proposal, and then there's a contract and that sort of thing. Another piece that I'd like to talk about is the funding, and on the list of items that you're sending back to the State Board of Education to study and to make reports on. I don't want to be cynical, but when I see a reference to study the funding levels and the funding methods, I'm not thinking that the idea is to fund these schools at a higher level than they're already funded. I'm thinking the thinking might be to fund them at a lower level than they're already funded. And maybe that's cynical, but that's certainly what I have heard over the last several years, that that's a goal of some folks. And I guess, again, want to go on the record saying that we would be concerned about further underfunding any charter school students, including those in online charter schools, because they already receive considerably less funding. They don't receive funding for facilities. They don't receive funding for things that they would need as a brick-and-mortar school already, and they're already underfunded. So our that just continues to be a concern. Also, we don't fund schools based on their model. We fund them on a student basis. So going down the path of funding an online school student at a different level than a brick-and-mortar student also concerns us. And if we're going to fund an online student at a certain level, shouldn't it be the same level whether they're in a charter or a district school or an ESD school? So I just want to express that. Perhaps the State Board should study the funding levels and methods for all online schools, comprehensive online schools, whether they be hybrid or full-time or whatever, in ESDs and districts and charters. That might make more sense. We do support, just want to say, the Department of Education's draft rules, particularly the definition of a virtual charter school as a charter school offering at least half of its program in an online format, which would eliminate some of the concerns expressed by the brick-and-mortar folks and that we've expressed over and over and over about collateral damage and who are we really trying to, you know, regulate through this process. So just for the record, we support that. We certainly are remaining willing to help however we can with some of the residency issues. You know, the 50% residency issue from 05, as Representative Dembro said to me recently, has taken on a life of its own, you know, and is that really the right way to protect districts and regulate those things? That probably requires further study. I know it's not in this concept. We certainly would continue to support the notion of separating online charter schools from traditional charter schools, and is ORS 338 really the right place for these schools on a long-term basis? We would certainly be interested in exploring that. So we remain willing to help however we can and appreciate your work and appreciate the opportunity to testify. Happy to take any questions.
So I had a question. There's an issue that's come up that's not addressed specifically in this bill, and I believe it's going to become a committee bill in the House Education Committee so that the relating clause is broad enough. But can you talk a little bit, would your organization be supportive of language that clarifies that it's not legal to pay cash incentives to families for enrolling their children in any public school?
Absolutely.
All right, great.
Matter of fact, I was really floored to see that piece. Yes, absolutely. We would support that.
Thank you.
Prohibiting that. We would be dismayed to hear that people were doing that. We're not aware of that, but we certainly would support prohibiting that.
All right. Thank you. And to clarify in this room, I don't think there's been any suggestion that ORCA or ORVA has done such a thing. So, I saw questions.
LC 15, hi, Karen. LC 15 includes a recommendation for whether virtual public charter schools should be required to admit part-time students. There was some question of whether that should be a requirement or not. Do you have a position on that, please?
I don't know that I do. And I've thought about that. I've talked with some of the virtual schools. By the way, I know we keep talking about ORCA and ORVA. We also have maybe 9 other online charter schools that may or may not be impacted by this. I was talking with Tim King earlier this morning about this issue of the part-time. I didn't know, actually, if he had part-time students now. They have about 1,100 kids in all of their web academies right now combined. And he said they don't, but that they would be open to that. I think it's kind of complicated to do part-time students in charter schools, period. My understanding is there's the half-time funding and the full-time funding. Funding, and that's really it. So I think there would be some analysis required to do that. I think, you know, the whole issue of a hybrid school, you know, this brings up that issue. And I think for students who are in traditional public schools in districts who take online courses, we would not consider that a hybrid online charter school. First of all, they're not in a charter school. I suppose, theoretically or broadly speaking, it would be a hybrid model. But when I think about a hybrid model for an online charter school, I think about, you know, what Brad is doing with Clackamas Web Academy, where the students are online for some of their program or distance remote from a physical location with teacher and other peers, but then together for other pieces. That would be more of a hybrid. So I think the further definition on that also needs to happen. I think that's connected to the part-time piece.
Great, that's really helpful.
Are there further questions or comments for Karen? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And our last panel of the day, has everyone that wants to sign up signed up? Yes, all right. Ginger Redlinger, Chuck Bennett, and Lori Satinsville.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I've been nominated to talk to you first about issues that this panel, I think, has identified. If I may, Madam Chair, I'd like to just go through the bill. It would be, for me, the easiest way to address these, or the LC, rather. And start with Section 1. I want you to know how pleased we are that there will be a guarantee that students in virtual schools will have the same kind of licensed personnel at all levels in their education. We believe that's best for children. And was something that we had recommended to you. We're glad to hear that so many of the virtual schools are following that model. We think that's the appropriate way to deal with identifying qualified educators. We would go then to page 3, and I want to just sort of run through this whole section on page 3 and page 4 that's the new language, just saying again, this was an issue we raised with the committee among others, and are very pleased to see the kind of enrollment notification and withdrawal notification suggested here. Again, we're very supportive. On page 5, subsection 4, just above section 2 on lines 2 through 4, Karn mentioned her concerns with this. We weren't sure we understood what this meant either, and I thought in listening to the discussion that it may be this piece of language references the issue you described coming up in a separate LC draft coming out of the committee, this idea that there would be some sort of bounty paid for student enrollment is disturbing. I mean, that's there's kind of a concern there. I can't imagine it going on and haven't heard of it before. This is the first time I've heard of that. Because I couldn't figure out what this language was about, I wondered if this referenced that.
I think that this language is about concerns that were raised about some advertising online, free homeschooling materials, and free computer enroll, so that any of those would need to disclose that it was a publicly funded. I mean, no school is free. Somebody's always paying, and clarifying that it's public.
Okay, I see what you're saying. I would hope you would take this, just a thought, it'd be to take the concern, the concept here, and roll it into your other bill where you're taking where you're handling other identified potential advertising or kickback or whatever you want to call these issues that you view as inappropriate. Put them all in one bill and perhaps get it out of this bill. Just a suggestion. I mean, you've kind of identified issues. Things that might be practices in terms of student recruitment you don't like, that would be part of that issue. So I just a thought on that. Then moving on, Madam Chair, I'm going to go to probably the most difficult section is Section 6, and I want to just make sure I understand a couple of aspects of this. We really appreciate that the task force is recommending to the state board that there be a close look at the appropriate governance model. We, of course, have testified to you. We believe the governance model is best served when you separate a virtual school from charter school. That charter school concept is based on a different kind of geographic limitation that occurs just by locale of brick-and-mortar schools. Virtual, by its very nature, has no boundaries, and that it actually represents a different kind of potential governance model. So we would hope that you would ask the state board to, or that the state board ultimately will clarify that. Then I go down to sub D which is lines 30 and 31 on page 8, ensures that there is competition among providers of educational services. I can only understand this in terms of a suggestion that we made, and if I'm wrong, I'd sure like to get it clarified, that what you're talking about here is the RFP process, that you're talking about competition among providers of virtual education. Otherwise, it doesn't. That seems to be the way it reads. I'm not sure it's clear. I just want to make sure I understand
Senator
what
Devlin?
You're talking about here.
Let me try to clarify that. Of all the sections in this draft, I think the co-chair and I have highlighted this section as potentially the most confusing, the one that probably needs the most work. And to be honest, it's because we do need to revise it, but we very consciously listened to the task force, listened to the testimony, and basically decided what we could address now and what should be addressed in the future. And the governance issue was one that was so large that we believed we could not address it now. However, we also wanted to ensure that the board came forward with legislation to address it in 2011, but that it came forward with legislation, not that the board would decide on the governance model. I actually think under the current statute, the board probably doesn't have the authority to actually change governance model. So that's kind of a moot issue. But this ensures that there's competition amongst providers of educational services was clearly aligned with the issue that was brought up here about that a virtual public charter school in particular should be able to make the choice of which provider it has for those services. That should be within their latitude to make that choice. They shouldn't be necessarily tied permanently to one provider. And I haven't actually heard an objection from any of the providers to language like that, because they're in a competitive field. Competition is part of the private sector. So that was the intent of that. But I think of all the sections in here that need work, this section needs work.
Certainly agree with you, Mr. Co-Chair. But I am pleased with your clarification. I think it would be good to have that that could be clarified further, unless it's just construction and I'm not seeing the relationships among the various clauses, that it would read ensures that there is competition among providers of virtual charter school education services, in order to clarify that
Madam
we're talking
Co-Chair.
About that.
Yes, Mr.
I think
Co-Chair.
Part of it is just basically, I think Legislative Council did a very good job in the draft overall, but understand that all of those sections should be read in light of subsection A, develop a governance model.
Okay.
Not more broadly than that.
Okay.
And so, but I think, to be honest, I think there are a number of things here that probably we just need to get some more clarity in this language, and I don't think I'll take the fault for it. I don't I'm going to take fault for it. I hope she doesn't mind. I'm going to attribute fault to both of us. I don't think we gave clear enough direction to legislative council on this particular item.
Well, good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The main thing is that as you instruct the Board of Education on its the information or the LCs you're asking for or other concepts, hopefully, I guess from our perspective, clarity is very helpful for the State Board. I'm sure it's helpful for us as we interact with the State Board about these issues to understand really clearly what the task force is talking about. I think I understand it. I would suspect that lobbyists for other organizations will understand exactly the opposite, so the clarity will be very important when we get to the point we're talking to the State Board about this. So I just bring it up. There were some other portions of this. I think I'll just move along. Again, on page 9, lines 6 through 10, we are very pleased to see this in here. There is an ongoing, if there was any, and I'll just call them sort of rumors at this point, because you begin to wonder, because everybody has such a totally different perspective on these issues, but one of those has been special education and how it's being treated inside the online school system. And I think having this very clear, very well understood helps everybody. I think there is a belief among some portions of the education community that special ed students are not being openly accepted into online. I think there is probably an alternative truth, and I think this will get it right down to the bottom as to what the responsibilities are to special needs children. And I was just very pleased to see this in here as, again, something we were interested in.
And can I make a clarification if I understand some of the driving issue behind this? If I go back to Mr. Wilkes' testimony about their commitment to hiring special education staff, even though they aren't funded to do so, because in the statute right now we break apart the student basically, and we give the funding for regular education half of the student to the virtual school and the special education half of the student. I don't know if that's the torso or the leg to the school district, and part of this goes to how do you better manage that to wrap around the student? How do you better manage that to wrap around the student in terms of ensuring a smooth delivery of service?
Yeah, and that's a very good question, and it's one that I don't think is resolved by going into the formula and somehow redefining students based on the delivery system. I really agree with Karn in that discussion. That is not where you go to do this. The formula is about students and their characteristics, not about delivery systems and their characteristics. So as we approach this, I really would advise you to look at other, and I'm sure you will, look at alternatives to how you do get that wraparound. Too often, I think a lot of folks who haven't looked at that, not you, but a lot of folks who haven't looked at that formula closely misunderstand what it's all about and how it works. It's not the issue, but I think we need to find another way to deal with that question. I could really hear it in Mr. Wilkes' testimony, and it is he's pointing to an interesting problem if you're going to expect a full delivery of services to special ed students.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ginger Redlinger. I'm currently employed by the Oregon City School District. I'm here on my own, not representing anybody. 20-year educator. Talk about hybrids. I'm a member of COSA, OEA, and Northwest Center for Educational Options. So, as you can see, I'm really neutral on these things. I'm really kind of happy with the progress that you're making. You still got a ways to go, but you're making good progress. I wanted to share some impacts of what's going on in the community, in the education community, in the brick-and-mortar schools and the charter developer schools, from my perspective, over the last year. more about my background. I've taught exceptionally gifted students, and I've taught life skill students, English language learners, newcomers, to students who were highly academically proficient and low in English skills. So I get that there's a difficulty in virtual education, and it's going to take a partnership with the existing system for everyone to have their needs met. I don't advocate for anyone here having any of their systems shut down for any reason. Everyone's doing a good job. There's lots of room for everyone. There are needs out there that can't be met unless we have a variety of options for all kids. Bottom line, each student has to be challenged. They have to be moved from their comfort zone. I'm an advocate of alternatives, including a Twilight School program that I started at Oregon City High School, which, by the way, is an outstanding school. Over 2,300 students. We've received two accommodations from different universities, including Stanford, this year for our performance of kids continually in the dean's list. Making schools online education available has helped those kids on the other end as well. For example, we had a credit recovery program that we used Odysseyware to access, and it allowed 23 kids to graduate who would not have done so because of the high school's ability to work within the rules, in the partnerships, and access services that they didn't have available to help kids catch up. I'm a planning principal currently this year for the Clackamas Academy of Industrial Sciences that will be opening in conjunction and in partnership with Clackamas Community College and with local industries. We have 9 different industries that are represented in our board, and everyone agrees virtual education is critically important. We're not moving away from it, we're moving towards it, but the key issue here is oversight. I've watched it grow. What's critical, and what I found in my experience with online education, is for the most part it's information. It's information that's delivered, it's information that's received, it's information that's assessed, and the learning really occurs in that dialogue between the students and the teachers, and that part shouldn't be lost. I notice that you're addressing some of those in the legislation here. I'm glad to see that. I don't think you can quantify it, whether 6 is enough or not enough or too much. It's all going to depend on the student and me as a learner and the students that I have. 185 days of contact with a teacher who's highly qualified and knows a lot about their subject area is the best thing that you can do anytime. There are more enriched models of online learning that we haven't even started talking about when we talk about virtual charters or online learning. For example, the education program for gifted youth out of Stanford University. I've proctored those courses for several of my students throughout my career in mathematics particularly, and that's a daily meeting with teachers that includes a 1 to 2 hour conference at the end of the week between students and teachers in a Skyping type situation. And the class progressively increases the level of challenge for the student based on how much progress they're making. So it adapts online. So it's not you don't just buy a course, and when you're setting standards for how you're going to operate a virtual learning environment, it's not a package. You have to really look at the student to make sure, like Cindy was talking about, that whoever your student is, whatever their needs are, that the course adjusts. It's just not a can that you buy and, buy and let it run, and then the kids earn their credits. It's a model, but again, at least to the EPGY program at Stanford, it's based on student outcomes, not a bottom line. So it's critical to have some sort of standard set for what we want for these kids in this. When I envision what's possible on online education, I'm caused to think about when we come up with virtual charter legislation, thinking about the bigger picture. What about kids who want to study the history of African democracy from, say, a university in Johannesburg? Or learn about the history of slavery in America from students who have done primary source research at a traditional black college? There are so many opportunities and access that we can have through virtual learning that we have to keep the bigger picture in mind when we're thinking about rules for a virtual charter, because you can cut off accidentally learning opportunities that you didn't mean to. So please, when you're thinking about virtual charters, don't just think about business rules. Think about the bigger picture. picture too. With that in mind, and those are the good things, there are a couple things that happened in my exploration of virtual charters over the past year. This August, I went to a military educators tour. My goal was to find out what their view was on online learning. What I discovered and wanted to share with the panel is that it is a Tier 3 entry level. Tier 2 is a GED. Tier 1 is a regular high school diploma. So in effect, what the military is saying is students who engage in most of their learning online are put on a case-by-case basis. It's not a blanket entry into the military. I asked them why, because I can think of some online programs that were high quality, and they said it's because of what the student can do in the military, not because of what kind of education they received online. So there are other outside agencies besides legislators, besides educators, who are critics of what the outcomes are of virtual education. I encourage you to look to some of those people as well. Talk to some military recruiters, and I encourage my students to do the same when they're thinking about enrolling in online education. I say, great, that's a great option for you. However, you told me you want to go in the military, go talk to your recruiter. Find out what the implications of that decision might mean for you. Second thing, since you brought it up, there was I did hear at a charter school meeting that one of the academies is offering parents $150 for enrolling their students per course. I haven't confirmed that, but it has come up, and it came up in this context. What will the public perception of charter schools be if this is actually true? And people are very concerned about it. I have an email from my school secretary that I want to read to you. This is another implication of the interface and the rules that you're starting to address in virtual academies, but why it's really important for you to think about the details. Working with these academies has been frustrating. When they have requested records for students, many times our students have still been enrolled in our school. I have spoken with them several times and asked them not to request records unless the student is actually attending. I check every time now just to be sure. On a follow-up conversation with the secretary, she told me that she spoke with one of our parents about the records request. The parent said she had not given permission for a records request and was not withdrawing her child from the school, but only had called the academy to ask a few questions. So there are some things going on out there that need the oversight need is there. Please pay careful attention to that. Students' records are protected by federal law. So that means the respect of the laws that are in place to protect students' records should be part of this conversation and part of the oversight as well. As a citizen, I hope that the elected officials stay engaged in this work. I appreciate what you're doing. I encourage you to keep it up. The citizens need to be able to access their legislators, their local school boards, and their organizations regarding education laws that impact all schools, virtual or not. Don't hand it off to anybody else. Don't direct anybody else to do the work, please. Get help from everyone else, but keep this as a legislative task so that we can have citizens access it more. One thing is a simple fix. I noticed you were talking a lot about and you mentioned the same thing about the RFP process and virtual competition. I know my charter school contract with my school district calls for anything over a certain amount having to go to a bidding process, as is the district policy. There might be some simple fixes there that are already in place. So I would encourage you to consider basic accounting principles and rules that are already there that can help resolve this issue without having to add something different to it. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Ms. Fattenspiel.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Lori Sattenstill from the Oregon School Boards, for the record. Madam Co-Chair Gelser and Chair Devlin. I wasn't going to testify, and I read through the LC. Chuck covered it admirably, I might add. And I wanted to pass on a few comments. We recently had our convention in Portland. And a couple of things that we did this year was we had a charter school workshop and an online virtual school workshop, and then we had what we call our hot topics table. And some of the things that are addressed in this LC were continual and very much a thread throughout the conference. The need to break the statute, unpack it. Let's have them separate. It's much clearer for everyone involved. At least is what the feedback we were getting in our discussions.
Special needs came up again, kind of being sure students were getting the services they deserve in an appropriate time frame. And I know there was a bill last session that maybe would make that more consistent with district-to-district movement of students. Charter school gets a little bit unclear for some folks, and that was brought up. The financial impact to some, and again, some of this is spilling over into bricks and mortar, is the financial piece, and I think that's being addressed here, as was in 767. Probably the biggest thing that I kept hearing was the student enrollment. Where is the student? Where is this student? Districts kept saying, I don't know where this student is. So I think some discussion was mentioned about maybe there's too much information here about the student, but I think the more information and as quickly as the district knows when that student is leaving and when that student has left a virtual online is extremely important. And we're still working with the district who has gotten an invoice from a virtual charter school for students that they can't track down. They are not going to pay them for students that they can't track. So that's a huge issue for folks in the district. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there any questions or comments for this panel, Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Co-Chair Gelser. Ginger, I had a question about a sentence that you have in your written testimony. You say that you want to make sure that the money given to schools is used only for its intended purpose to educate children. And I wondered if you were referencing that alleged payment that was made to families for enrollment. Is that the kind of thing, or is there something else
no,
there that you're...
No, that's...
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
And we will be having a committee bill on the House side to address that issue in February.
Thank you.
Are there further questions or comments? All right. We are going to take a brief break for 10 minutes to give you an opportunity to sort through all the information you just heard and possibly reread through LC 15. So we'll come back at... Should we give them 13 and come back at 10 until?
No.
Oh, yes. So we'll come back at 10:40. We are in recess.
I don't know.